Welcome to The Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about The Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. Stay tuned for tonight's special report on global warming when we come back. You know, 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our fathers, rather, "You shall not have in your bag diverse weights of great and small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures of great and small, but you shall have a perfect and a just weight. A perfect and a just measure shall you have." But you know, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention back in 1787 followed this scriptural prescription when they put, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts," into our federal constitution at Article 1, Section 10. But back in 1933, President Roosevelt took our gold away, and in 1964, President Johnson took silver coin out of circulation. Now, in place of just weights and balances, these two presidents have introduced our current practice of the first, second, and fifth planks of the Communist Manifesto into our monetary system. They have given us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills and clad coinage in place of silver coins. Now, in the intervening 70 years or so, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until today we're the world's number one debtor nation. Now, who do you think were the better financial planners for our nation? Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Baines Johnson? If you'd like to learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, it's another of the many lessons in my Mosaic Law School, conducted twice a year here at the law school. If you'd like to learn more, just call and order my free general law CD package. Now, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call right now. The number is 417-273-4967 to order yours. The Mosaic Law School and the Business School is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, just go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Environment and climate news is published by the Heartland Institute. Heartland Institute's webpage is heartland.org. It's heartland.org. They published an article in the February 2005 edition of Environment and Climate News. A guy by the name of Michael Crichton wrote a book concerning global warming. If you're anything like I am, you know you've read and heard and Dan Rather and all the mainstream media boys, you know, they talk about global warming. And then, of course, David Letterman and Leno, they get on the air and they make jokes about it, you know, about how you're going to have beachfront property in Nevada, you know, one of these days because of global warming. What is the truth about global warming? Is it a real problem? Or is it like that refrigerant story, you know, they came to us and said, "Well, you know, this Freon is degrading the environment, so therefore we've got to do away with Freon and substitute it with some new refrigerant gas so that we can sell everybody in the world new refrigerators." I suspect the latter, but let's take a look at global warming. A guy by the name of Crichton, Michael Crichton, wrote a book. It's a top-selling novel. Contains hard science exposing the folly of this global warming alarmism. So I thought I'd share with you some thoughts from Environment and Climate News. Remember, you can get a copy of Environment and Climate News, which is The Monthly Newspaper for Common Sense Environmentalists, Volume 8, Number 2, February 2005, from the Heartland Institute. Just go to heartland.org, heartland.org. Here's the story. Michael Crichton, author of best-selling books and blockbuster movies such as The Andromeda Strain and Jurassic Park, has published a new best-selling book. Now, that much is hardly noteworthy, given his track record of literary success. What is noteworthy, even earth-shaking, is the book's accurate and tenacious presentation of the science of global warming theory. Crichton has made the often arcane debate over global warming entertaining and accessible to a huge segment of the American public. The result could be a pivotal moment in the history of environmentalism. Already, Crichton is being compared to Rachel Carson and Upton Sinclair. Millions of people who believe whatever they hear or read from environmental advocacy groups are in the process of changing their minds. Well, I haven't read the book, so I'm not going to review the book. I'm going to review the article and let you decide what it is that turns your mind one way or the other. I mean, after all, you got a brain, you can figure out for yourself what it is you want to believe. But here's a short synopsis of the main topics and the page numbers in the book. Let me share this with you. How much of the science in State of Fear is accurate and how much is fiction? Well, here's a summary of the scientific claims about global warming that appear in this book. Most of the warming in the past century occurred before 1940, before carbon dioxide emissions could have been a major factor. That's on page 84. Global temperatures fell between 1940 and 1970, even as CO2 levels were increasing. That's on page 86. Temperature readings from reporting stations outside the United States are poorly maintained and staffed and probably inaccurate. Those in the United States, which are probably more accurate, show little or no warming trend. That's on pages 88 and 89. Full professors from MIT, Harvard, Columbia, Duke, Virginia, Colorado, UC Berkeley, and other prestigious schools, the former president of the National Academy of Sciences, will argue that global warming is at best unproven and at worst a pure fantasy. That's on page 90. Temperature sensors on satellites report much less warming in the upper atmosphere, which the theory of global warming predicts should warm first, than is reported by temperature sensors on the ground. That's on page 99. And data from weather balloons agree with the satellites. That's on page 100. Antarctica as a whole is getting colder and the ice is getting thicker. Page 193. Sources listed on page 194. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, called the IPCC, is a huge group of bureaucrats and scientists under the thumb of bureaucrats, and its 1995 report was revised after the scientists themselves had gone home, on pages 245 and 246. James Hansen's predictions of global warming during a congressional committee hearing in 1988, which launched the global warming scare, were wrong by 300%. 35 degrees Celsius over the next 10 years versus the actual increase of 0.11 degrees in 1998. Hansen said long-term predictions of climate are impossible. Pages 246 and 247. There has been no increase in extreme weather events such as floods, tornadoes, and droughts over the past century or in the past 15 years. Computer models that have been used to forecast climate change do not predict more extreme weather. On pages 362 and then 425 and 426. Temperature readings taken by terrestrial reporting stations are rising because they are increasingly surrounded by roads and buildings which hold heat. The urban heat island effect, page 368 and page 369. Methods used to control for this effect have failed to reduce temperatures enough to offset it, pages 369 and 376. Changes in land use and urbanization may contribute more to changes in the average ground temperature than global warming caused by human emissions, pages 383 and 388. Carbon dioxide has increased a mere 60 parts per million since 1957. That's a tiny change in the composition of the atmosphere. That's reported on page 387. Increased levels of CO2 act as a fertilizer, promoting plant growth and contributing to the shrinking of the Sahara Desert, page 421. Sea levels have been rising at the rate of 10 to 20 centimeters, that's 4 to 8 inches every 100 years for the past 6,000 years, that's on page 424. And the Kyoto Protocol, if successful, would reduce temperatures by only 0.04 degrees Celsius in the year 2100. That's on page 478. Change, not stability, is the defining characteristic of the global climate, with naturally occurring events such as volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, and tsunamis much more likely to affect climate than anything humans do. That's on page 563. And then finally, computer simulations are not real-world data, and they cannot be relied on to produce reliable forecasts. That's on page 566. Now, Crichton backs up many of these assertions by presenting the scientific data and or by providing web links and references to the scientific journals that document the facts. As one character in State of Fear summarizes, the threat of global warming is essentially non-existent. Let me repeat that. The threat of global warming is essentially non-existent. Even if it were a real phenomenon, it would probably result in a net benefit to most of the world. That's on page 407. I got a comment right here that global warming is a product of evolutionary philosophy. If, in fact, there is a God, then what's the problem? Let him take care of it. Let him solve his own problems. That's not my bailiwick, and I don't need to get concerned about it. If, on the other hand, there is no God, well, then there might be something to worry about. There might be some real concern there if, in fact, there's some real science to back it up. But let's take a look at real science. Number one, we know that way, way back. How far is way, way back? Well, if there is a God, it's way, way back, about 4,000 years. If it's evolutionary philosophy you're talking about, way, way back, there was more oxygen content in the atmosphere of planet Earth than there is today. Today it's about 21%. It was 38% way, way back. You pick the date. We know that from oxygen air bubble samples from amber. Amber. It's a resin that comes out of trees. And that resin, pitch, is commonly called out here in the woods, will catch little insects and sometimes even animals. Mice have been caught in amber and fossilized. And when you look at the oxygen content at 38%, there was a change at some point in time in our atmosphere from 38% oxygen down to 21%. Now let's think about this in terms of carbon dioxide. We humans breathe in oxygen and give off carbon dioxide. The carbon dioxide is the oxygen is the stuff of which plants breathe. And it's only about 0.5% in the atmosphere. But plants need it. So when carbon dioxide increases, plant growth increases. Now I find it hard to believe that plant growth is a pollutant. At some time in the past, way, way back, you pick the date, 4,000, 4 million years ago, 4 billion, whatever turns you on, there was greater flora and fauna on planet Earth than there is today. There were more plants and more animals at times in the past. And we see that when we go up to the Arctic Circle and dig around, we find mammoths by the millions buried up there. There aren't any up there today. There were more mammoths and there was more life forms at the North and South Poles than there is today. Furthermore, the petroleum that has been accruing or has accrued in the past in the Earth's crust comes from a great burying of animals and plants. Coal seams 100 feet thick, 200 feet thick out in Wyoming didn't get there accidentally. Those are the remains of huge flotsam accumulations of plant matter that has become coal. Hey, listen, if the oxygen was 38%, then the CO2 had to have been higher. That would mean that there was global warming in the past. In fact, if we take a look at the tropical plants that are found in the northern latitudes and down in Antarctica, it would tell us that the Earth was at one time a tropical paradise. More than likely, the CO2 content and the temperature of the Earth was much higher. Does that necessarily mean that that would be bad for planet Earth if it warmed up? Well, all of the ice caps, they tell us, are going to melt. Okay, so all the ice caps melt. Is that going to inundate the whole world? No, not at all. And if that were the case, would we then have more rain, more moisture in the atmosphere? Higher levels of CO2 would mean greater plant growth, and even though we lost coastal areas today, would that necessarily spell doom for planet Earth or for mankind upon it? Those are speculative questions. I, for one, sit back and say, why don't we relax, sit down, fold our hands, shut up and do what we're told for a change, and let God worry about it. It's His bailiwick, it's His planet. That's His problem in life, not mine. But Creighton goes on and has a little bit more to say. And there's a book review here. Now remember, we're reviewing the Heartland Institute paper. They put out 3 or 4 papers, one on education. This one happens to be on environment and climate news. It's the monthly newspaper for common sense environmentalists. All right, that's Heartland Institute. You can get to them on the web at heartland.org. That's heartland.org. This particular review, volume 8, number 2, February 2005. Creighton strikes a devastating blow to alarmists. Listen to this. The book, the new book, State of Fear is the title of it. State of Fear, published by HarperCollins in 2004, is $27.95. It's the story of a philanthropist, a scientist, a lawyer, and 2 remarkable women who discover a plot hatched by environmental extremists to trigger environmental catastrophes that they will blame on global warming. With global warming firmly tied to a series of real, undeniable, and cataclysmic catastrophes, the plotters believe that world leaders will finally see what sound science has so far failed to reveal, and that is the need for a radical green agenda that cripples free market forces and, not just coincidentally, pours billions and billions of dollars into the coffers of environmental advocacy groups. And it sounds just like the Wall Street Journal, doesn't it? Now, racing against time to foil the planned catastrophes, these protagonists face a series of breathtaking adventures that make the book impossible to put down. Along the way, characters present a devastating critique of global warming, alarmism, and mainstream environmentalism that you read about today. Now, Creighton has his characters produce lists of references in scientific journals showing that Antarctica is cooling rather than warming, graphs showing cooling trends in many cities around the world, and a blizzard of facts and figures on everything from species extinction rates to the use of DDT. And Crichton concludes his book with an eloquent call for a new environmental movement based on facts instead of fear. It's really more silly than scary. Environmentalists who have used scare tactics and junk science in the past are understandably alarmed by the book. The Sierra Club calls it a polemic, a screed, even dressed up as bad fiction. The Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC, which Crichton delightfully reinvents as NERF, the organizational base for his novel's arch-villain, calls the book more silly than scary, and accuses Crichton of building a fantasy world where global warming is not a real threat, but global warming scientists are. Actually, global warming scientists are the heroes in State of Fear, while government bureaucrats and self-serving professional activists are the real threat. For example, Crichton refers to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change as a huge group of bureaucrats and scientists under the thumb of more bureaucrats, and reports accurately that its 1995 report was revised without their consent after the scientists themselves had gone home. That's on page 245 and 246. State of Fear is a 600-page tirade about global warming, complained Brian Curtis in a December 8th article in the left-leaning Slate online magazine. This isn't to say that Crichton doesn't believe his right-leaning contrarian poses. It's his belief in these poses that is the problem. And the often shrill New York Times calls State of Fear a shrill, preposterous, right-wing answer to this year's shrill, preposterous, but camply entertaining global warming disaster movie, The Day After Tomorrow. So that's what the global warming pro-lobby of the global warming, what are we going to call them, the global warmanists, are criticizing Crichton's book. Well, after reviewing the facts and figures that I've seen come in, I can't definitively tell you if the Earth is warming or not. What do I know about it? All I know is what I read in the papers. That's what Will Rogers finally concluded. He says, well, I don't know. I read it in the papers, and I got one group over here telling me that if we don't stop this global warming, why, we're all doomed. And then another side over here says, well, I think these guys are just trying to fleece your pocketbook. But until I see something more definitive, I'd tend to go with this guy Crichton. There's another article over here I want to share with you. It's called U.S. Stands Firm at the Climate Change Talks. Now, you know, back in the 90s, there was a protocol. They call it the Kyoto Protocol. A bunch of scientists and government bureaucrats got together in Kyoto, Japan. And they came to the conclusion that the world was doomed because it's warming, and that we have to solve a problem over here. I suspect that it has something to do with this Global 2000 program, the New World Order. Not quite sure why the United States is opposed to it, but there's only two countries in the world that wouldn't sign up, and the United States is one of them. That's kind of an anomaly. I don't know quite what to make of that. It's the United States that's the driving force behind the New World Order, and yet if this global warming is a New World Order program, you'd think the United States would be front and center over here trying to con everybody else in the world into joining up. So in reality, that says to me that, gee, maybe there is global warming and the United States over here, for its own interests over here, is opposing it on economic grounds. And there's going to be some big economic consequences if we join up with this Kyoto Protocol, because they want to stop the generation of power. And right now, you know, we burn a lot of coal. If you want to take a look at the use of coal, I happened to be out in Nebraska not too long ago, right along Interstate Highway, 80 or 84. You go over about a mile or two, and you'll come onto the old Highway 30. And right along Highway 30, going through these little towns out in western, out in the western part of Nebraska, you'll see four railroad tracks, four Union Pacific railroad tracks. I mean, this is an artery. And it runs east-west, and it comes down out of Wyoming. And every 15 minutes, there's a coal train, and these coal trains have 109 cars on them, 109 coal cars. And all this coal is coming every 15 minutes on three tracks eastbound, and then there's one track westbound for the empties. And these loaded coal trains, 109 cars, every 15 minutes on three tracks headed eastbound, are hauling coal out of Wyoming to the power plants of America to make our electricity. I mean, it's a sight that just bedazzles me. You know, when I saw it, I thought, my God, I've never seen anything like this before. And this goes on, I imagine, 24 hours a day. Now, I didn't sit there day after day and count all these cars. I don't know whether at nighttime they run empty trains up the other direction and the loaded trains down. I'm just reporting to you that that's what I observed. I probably watched them, you know, for 6 or 8 hours as we drove along there. I stopped every once in a while to watch these trains go by. And they're burning all that coal. Now, you'd think that if global warming was being affected by the burning of all of this coal over here, we ought to have some kind of definitive answer. And this guy, Crichton, says that, nope. You take a look at the numbers and the reporting, and I saw a report on this not too long ago. I'll share it with you. They put up these, they put up a thermometer. And they monitor this thermometer, and they do this year after year, and at some point in time, somebody comes along and says, well, we've been watching this thermometer at this location over the past 10, 15, 20 years, and we find that the temperature here at this location has gone up by a degree or two or five or whatever their numbers are. Well, some guy got to thinking about that one day. And I think this was reported on Nova or something on that order. I saw it here on one of these public affairs TV programs. And he said, did you notice that when they put these thermometers out here, they put it right out next to the blacktop? Yeah, right out next to the blacktop. Now, if you go into a city, and in a city environment, you know, like Los Angeles, where it's all concrete and glass and steel and blacktop and cement on the streets, and there isn't any trees, and it's all been cut off and paved over, it's warmer in the cities than it is in the countryside outside the cities. Well, I can see that. I've noticed that when you walk across a blacktop parking lot, you burn your feet sometimes on a good hot day. Stand out there in the blacktop in the sun. It's pretty damn hot. And that's why people kind of like to go to the park. So you go over to the park where it's green and there's trees, and you stand under the shade, and you're standing on lawn instead of hot blacktop, it's a little cooler. Have you ever noticed that? If you haven't, test it. Go stand in a parking lot that's black, absorbing the sun's rays, and see if it isn't hotter there than when you walk across the street and stand on the lawn in the park. All right, well now, when they go out here and measure these temperatures, they like to be able to drive up to these facilities. And so they'll put these facilities right alongside of a highway, a road, a parking lot or something like that where they take the measurements. Well, and my common sense tells me that it's probably going to be a little warmer there. Now, I just imagine that these guys, these scientists, if they've got good hard scientific evidence, probably have some temperature sensing devices down in Antarctica, and probably have some up on Mount Rainier, and probably have some down in the desert regions of the Sahara. I imagine if you're going to test global warming, my common sense would say to me that you'd probably have to have more than two or three temperature sensing sites, maybe more like 200 or 300, or maybe 2,000 or 3,000, and all of these sites would have to be at random locations. You'd have to have some in the Arctic regions, and some in the tropical regions, and some in the forests, and some in the cities, if you're going to test an average, wouldn't you? Well, according to Crichton, they're not doing that. So he wrote a book. And sometimes these novels, actually, can create more interest than can hard science. You know, when I come on the air and I cite statistics and facts and figures, it gets to be pretty dull and dry. Who in hell wants to listen to this fool rant on about all these problems over here and all these dry numbers? So some guy comes along and he writes a book. And he kind of pokes fun at it. And it's entertaining. And because it's entertaining, we will read it. I just watched 60 Minutes last night, and they were interviewing a guy down in Miami, Florida. He put forth a pretty salient point. He's talking about Florida being corrupt. The politics are corrupt, and the people that live there are pretty corrupt. And he's kind of poking fun at it. And he works for the Miami Herald. And so he said, listen, let's suppose you're an auto thief, and you live in Detroit, Michigan, and you're plying your craft, and you're stealing cars, and you make your living in Detroit. And some guy comes along and says, look, how would you like to ply your craft as an auto thief in Miami, Florida? Now, if you're an auto thief, would you rather ply your craft in Miami or Detroit? And he said, you know, most auto thieves would prefer a warmer climate, and so they moved to Miami or Dade County or, you know, Orlando or someplace in Florida where they can ply their craft. Now, there's a little tongue-in-cheek, little humor that goes along with it, and he's exposing all of the graft and corruption that goes on in the great state of Florida. Pretty funny story. And that's what this guy Crichton is doing. He's taking this subject matter of global warming, poking a little fun at it, and taking some hard science, and this will give us an opportunity to be entertained as we're reading this fictional account of what's going on around us. Now, Crichton had a little bit more to talk about here. Racing against time to foil these planned catastrophes, the protagonists face a series of breathtaking adventures that make the book impossible to put down. Along the way, characters present a devastating critique of global warming alarmism and mainstream environmentalism today. And he says, Crichton has his characters produce lists of references in scientific journals showing that Antarctica is cooling rather than warming, graphs showing cooling trends in many cities around the world, and a blizzard of facts and figures on everything from species extinction rates to the use of DDT. And Crichton concludes his book with an eloquent call for a new environmental movement based on facts instead of fear. So here again, you know, maybe a little entertainment along with the facts and figures that come from the hard scientists, some of them true, some of them false, some of them with an agenda and some of them without an agenda, will give you a little better perspective. The book is about $30, sounds like to me. For $30, it sounds like it's worth the entertainment value. Hey, we're at the halfway point. We got to take a break here and give you a couple of warnings here from the program and the network and everything so that we can tell you what's going on with the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Keep in mind that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the Law School. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs, by the way, are archived on the Internet by title and date. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The opinions, the beliefs, the comments, the views, the expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or the staff of this network or radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. It's an easy one, georgegordon.org. Or you can call direct 417-273-4967. And the article is contained in the Heartland Institute their paper called the Environment and Climate News. Now, Heartland Institute is a think tank. And their advertisement here on the back page says the right public policy choices could save the lives of millions of people starving in Africa and around the world. Did you know that? The Heartland Institute is a national nonprofit organization devoted to informing elected officials and the public on important public policy issues. The Heartland Institute publishes environment and climate news, as well as monthly newspapers on taxes, health care, and school reform, and other publications addressing a wide range of topics. So we invite you to join the more than 1,600 individuals, foundations, and corporations who want to make the world a better place. Have the satisfaction of knowing that you're working with others to restore the individual freedom and limited government that made this country great. And then they go on to tell you what the membership's values are and so on. I recommend them. I've been reading and reviewing their papers since I first came in contact with them at the Freedom Institute, I guess it was, out in Reno, Nevada last year. Went over to their booth, picked up some of their papers, and I was favorably impressed, and so I've shared with you three or four articles or points. And this one here on global warming, I think, probably hits the nail on the head. We hear constantly, we're bombarded with propaganda. There is very, very little information, hardcore, hard factual, scientific information on global warming. If you've seen it, you had to go search and dig it out from deep, deep in the recesses of the archives somewhere. All I've heard is the crap that I get over mainstream media. Now, if you want to dig into a subject, no, you can, and I guess if I wanted to dig into this a little more, I suppose I could, but I think that the Heartland Institute's filling a void here. It's called Environment and Climate News, and listen to the U.S. Stands Firm on Climate Change Talks. Now, this is a separate article, and I gave you the article on Crichton. Listen to this one. Research funding take priority over activist worries. Now, at the 10th conference of the parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, that's a mouthful, isn't it, which took place in Buenos Aires, Argentina during December, U.S. representatives took the initiative in presenting the Bush administration's view on the best way to research and address global warming concerns. The message overshadowed efforts by activist groups and European bureaucrats who sought to criticize America's stance on global warming. So the activists target America. Now, America is the primary target, reported Henry Lamb. Now, Henry Lamb is the executive vice president of the Environmental Conservation Organization. The United States and Australia are the only developed nations that have not ratified the protocol and are therefore targets for the wrath and ridicule of the rest of the world. Now, most of the delegates, however, care very little about global warming, Lamb continued. They care about the wealth the protocol is designed to transfer to them. I'm going to put a little bracket around that one. Let me come back to that again. As old Dan Rather so aptly put it, he said, you know, follow the money. Now, you take a look at what we saw here with refrigerant. You know, this Freon. They came to us one day and they said, hey, you know, this Freon that you've got in your refrigerator, that's really bad for the environment. Now, what in the hell do you and I know about Freon? Think about it for a minute. I don't know anything about Freon. I don't know anything about refrigerant. All I know is I open the door and the light goes on, and when I close the door, I wonder if the light goes off. That's all I know about a refrigerator. Well, it's cooler in the refrigerator than it is outside. So some guy comes along and says, my God, this Freon goes up into the atmosphere and it's going to kill us all. We're all doomed. You know, I say again, you know, why don't we let God take care of that problem? Why do I have to get real excited about it? So Some guy says to me, "My God, the oceans are getting deeper and the ice caps are melting." And I'm sitting here saying, "So what in the hell am I going to do about it?" The reason I point that out is that, you know, it seems like to me that a God that's able to build a solar system, able to put the sun into orbit up there, you know, or in the sky and run that thing for several thousand years, seems like he ought to be able to run the world. He's been doing it for several thousand years. Why does George Gordon have to get excited about it, you know, in my short, brief span here of 70 years and go vote for this guy or some other guy over here to solve problems that we can't solve? Now, I've said it before, I'm going to say it again. If you can't solve the problem, you don't need to worry about it. Boys and girls, you and I are not going to solve global warming, and neither is the U.S. government and the United Nations and all the rest of these guys running around here telling us they need more money to solve problems that are impossible. Reminds me of this guy, Carl Sagan. You remember that guy? He couldn't speak very, very well. He had a lisp. He said, "Billions and billions of years ago," or miles out into space. He was a great advocate of human beings colonizing space. You remember that? He's talking about, you know, these you know, life out in outer space. Hell, the Bible tells you there's lots of life out in outer space. God himself lives out there. There's billions of angels all over the universe. He says he sustains that universe out there. Sustains it. He built it and he runs it. So yeah, there's life out in outer space. All right, so now that question's been answered, if you've been wondering, is there intelligent life in outer space? Yeah, outer space is filled with intelligent life. That's what God's been telling us for 6,000 years. Now, Sagan was a great proponent of space travel, and so he'd talk, you know, about man going out and colonizing space. Now, I want to bring your attention to the fact that we humans live 70 years. 70 years. Also, I'd like to point out to you that we humans travel at about 25,000 miles an hour. When we get in those spaceships, you know, the space shuttle and so on, about 25,000 miles an hour. And I'd like to also point out that the closest star, I mean, outside of our solar system right here with our star, you know, our sun, our moon, and Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Neptune, Saturn, you know, and Uranus and so on. Did you know that outside of our little solar system right here with our nine planets or so, the nearest star is called Alpha Centauri, and it's 7,000 light years away. So if you could accelerate out to the speed of light, it'd take you 7,000 years to get out there to the next star. And this guy, Sagan, I mean, this guy has a PhD, or he did, he's dead now, but, you know, this guy's been to college. And you elect these PhDs and these fools to public office. And then you go to college and listen to these fools as they tell you. I just want to point out that I'm a crummy plumber, but I can tell you that mankind, in his present form, is not going out and colonizing outer space. It ain't going to happen. Now, you don't need to be a Rhodes Scholar. You don't need a PhD. In fact, if you got a PhD, you probably won't be able to grasp these concepts. But if you could travel at the speed of light, for crying out loud, it'd take you 7,000 years. That's longer than going back to the Garden of Eden to get out one way. That's just a one-way trip to the nearest solar system, which would be Alpha Centauri. Well, now listen to this going on here. The U.S. stands firm now at the climate change talks. The meeting began with a dispute over item 8 of the agenda, which focused, among other things, on disaster reduction. The United States objected to the item as irrelevant to Kyoto, and a heated debate ensued. The item is believed to have been placed on the agenda at the behest of non-government organizations wishing to test whether the U.S. can be sued over damages arising from climate-linked disasters. Sounds like money and lawyers to me, doesn't it? And of course, they'll be looting the taxpayers, and I guess that's you and me, isn't it? French Ecology Minister Sergei Lapalatier said, I'm convinced that we are going to bring the United States into Kyoto even if it doesn't want to. I want to point out that in the Bible, God told us not to engage in these covenants or contracts with foreign and alien gods. Now, I've pointed this out in the past. Let me do it again. France is a god. France is a sovereign nation. And they make law. God is a sovereign lawmaker. In fact, if you look at the legal definition of sovereign, it's a lawmaker. France is a lawmaker. The United States is a lawmaker. And a treaty is a contract. A treaty is a contract. It's a law that's engaged in by sovereigns, engaged in by people with sovereign powers, you know, like the United States and Great Britain and NATO and CETO and NAFTA and GATT. Those are treaties. Now, those are prohibited in the Scripture. Yeah, that's right. The God of creation, you know, the God of Abraham, he said, don't do that. So, of course, we Americans have to get involved in GATT and NAFTA and NATO and CETO and all these treaties. Well, the French are telling us over here that they're going to bring us into this Kyoto Treaty, whether we like it or not. So I'm opposed to it on the grounds that it's prohibited in Scripture. And a good Scripture in point would be Exodus 23, verses 32 and 33. Exodus 34, verses 10 through 17, be another good one. You know, there are certain things that God tells you to do and certain things that God tells you not to do, and this is one of the things he tells you not to do. All right, now U.S. funds new technology. With countries lining up to attack the U.S. position on Kyoto, American representatives defended their position. White House science advisor John Marburger told the December 5th Washington Post, quote, the U.S. position is maybe the only rational position to identify and promulgate application of new technologies. To do anything meaningful requires a dramatic cessation or reduction of economic activity. It's simply not practical at the present time. Now, let's pause here for a moment. You implement these world-reaching or these earth-shattering new programs over here, and it's going to affect your economy. For instance, I mentioned all that coal, you know, that's coming out here, and you're burning all this coal to generate your electricity. And I don't know what you think about coal-burning power plants and nuclear energy, etc., but let me ask you this. Are you opposed to electricity? I mean, if you're an American, except for about one half of 1% of the people of America, you have electricity in your house. You know, all of these anti-growth and these pro-environmental people, you know, will reach over and flip the switch just like you and I do, don't they? And each and every one of us flipping the switch over here is burning up some electricity. Now, you know, you flip on your switch and you don't have power, and the next thing you go reach for the telephone to call the power company and say, listen, I got a problem, there's no power here now, don't you? If you're anything like I am, you do. Now, these people are talking about making changes that are going to affect the amount of electricity that's going to be available. And the amount of electricity affects the amount of energy. The amount of energy affects the gross domestic product. It affects your bread and butter on your table, boys and girls. So whether you're in favor of more or less coal or more or less nuclear power or more or less oil drilling in the Arctic National Refuge, you depend upon electricity. And when you sign up on this Kyoto Treaty over here, it's going to affect the amount of power. It's going to affect your standard of living. Now, that ought to hit home. Now, U.S. negotiators publicly minced no words about joining Kyoto or anything resembling its targets and timetables of energy rationing. Got that? Energy rationing. Now, maybe we Americans are using too much energy, and maybe we ought to conserve a little bit more. You know, it is true. I could, when I walk out of this room, flip the switch and burn less electricity. I could probably stay home this afternoon and burn less gasoline. But you need to understand that if I stay home and burn less gasoline, then it's going to affect the guy over here at the DX station where we buy our gas. He's going to sell less gas. He's going to make less money. And he's going to have less money to spend because he's going to make less profit. If I drive my car less, it's going to last longer. It won't break down. And I won't have to take it to the mechanic, so it's going to affect the mechanic. You know, the more we drive, the more money goes into the economy. The more electricity we use, the more coal we burn, the more coal we mine, the more people that benefit from it. I'm just telling you, that's where reality's at. You know, just carry it to the opposite extreme. If energy conservation is good, wouldn't the cessation of energy use be even better? You know, the concept that these people are advocating over here in conserving energy, what they're in effect saying is you need to cut back on your standard of living. Your standard of living is based upon the amount of energy that you consume. You'll live better electrically because you have electricity available. Now, when I was a kid, you walked into the room and there was a cord dangling out of the middle of the ceiling in the room, in the middle of the room, and you reached up. I mean, when you walked in the room, you didn't reach in a dark room for a light switch on the wall. You groped around in the middle of the room, swinging your arms wildly, trying to find the cord that had this light socket on it, and it had a little turn switch, and you turned it, and it turned the light on in the room. Now, we didn't use near as much energy back in 1943 when I was a kid than you do as you do today. So when you talk about energy rationing over here, what you're talking about is we're going to contract your standard of living. Now, if that's what you want, then let's get after it. I'm not for or against it. I'm not telling you what to do. I'm just telling you that that's where the bottom line in the equation lies. It's where the rubber meets the road. Now, the senior fellow, Chris Horner, who attended the meetings, made these observations. And now, American Representative Dr. Harlan Watson, who had been described as irresponsible to the point of being criminal. God. If you're opposed to this Kyoto thing over here, then you're irresponsible to the point of being criminal. Well, I want to go on record as saying I'm not in favor of contracting my energy consumption. What I want to do is produce my own energy here in the United States. Now, I've mentioned this before, that when it comes to oil, you know, we Americans are sitting on top of 3.6 trillion barrels of oil. I don't know if you knew that or not. 3.6, that's 3,600. 3.6, yeah, 3,600 billion barrels. And we use 6 billion barrels a year. So let's divide that by 6, and what do we get? 600-year supply of oil. We Americans are sitting on top of a 600-year supply of oil at today's consumption rates. It doesn't send a signal to me that says that I need to turn my electricity off or that I need to conserve on energy. Now, from 1943, we now have light switches, and sometimes you'll have a light switch at the door on both sides of the room so that you have a three-way switch. You know, you can turn the lights on this side of the room and turn them off on the other side. Furthermore, you got outlets all the way around the room, and you probably have two or three lamps in the room. And then maybe you got a television plugged into one of those outlets, and maybe you got two or three other appliances, and maybe in the kitchen you got a dishwasher. You know, I would say that dishwashers and freezers and refrigerators make our lives today better than they were 50, 75, 100 years ago. Now, who in the hell in his right mind wants to give up on all that? Now, I would agree that consuming all this oil and wasting it on meaningless travel up and down the highways over here to get to our jobs is a waste of a natural resource. Probably would be better if we didn't do that. But before we get wild, you know, I think we ought to be thinking about more practical and intelligent solutions to the problem. And I don't think that Kyoto or the Kyoto protocols are one of them. Now, I'm amazed that the United States and Australia are opposed to the Kyoto protocols, being a couple of the primary motivators or factors in this thing called the New World Order. I don't quite understand that. I'm just a reporter. I don't understand everything that I report, but I'm here to tell you. Now, remember, this comes out of the Environment and Climate News, the monthly newspaper for Common Sense Environmentalists. You can get a copy. I suppose if you just got online, went to the Heartland Institute at heartland.org. All you have to do is type in Heartland, HEARTLAND.org, and you can get a copy of the February 2005 issue. Now, most of the delegates care very little about global warming. They care about the wealth that the protocol is designed to transfer to them. So says Henry Lamb. He's the executive vice president of the Environmental Conservation Organization. So, follow the money, I guess, is the bottom line to the story. Now, there are international partnerships here. Watson also drew attention to America's international efforts to foster partnerships aimed at addressing climate change without suppressing energy use. Now, I'm all in favor of that. I'm not opposed to addressing climate change or addressing the poor use of the energy that we're now utilizing. I think running power plants to generate electricity off of oil and natural gas is a waste of oil and natural gas that we could better use heating our homes. I don't think we need to generate electricity with natural gas. I think we should concentrate on using natural gas to heat our homes. Coal is a pretty good product here for generating electricity. I think hydropower is even better. I think nuclear energy is even better, you know. But I'm not in favor of cutting my standard of living. A guy one time came into class here and he said, "You know, Gordon, you charge too much for your classes." And I said, "Well, partner, how much is enough?" He didn't know. He didn't know. He didn't have a clue. Well, I've never met anybody that's got so much money or that has such a high standard of living that he wants to contract it. And the people that are advocating this are the very same people that have electricity in their houses, and I don't see them cutting back first. And in fact, cutting back on energy consumption is simply cutting back on standard of living. What we really want to do is consume more energy. But we want to do it in a way that doesn't depreciate our energy sources. And you know, the hydrologic process of running water over a turbine to generate electricity is a renewable resource. And what I hear these quacks telling us is that we need to tear out all the dams on the Columbia River. Now talk about insanity. I mean, they're talking about tearing out the dams on the Columbia River. And what are you going to replace that energy source with? They don't want nuclear power. They don't want coal. They don't want hydroelectric power. But I'll guarantee you this, they want electricity just like you and I do. So remember, that's the Environment and Climate News. Environment and Climate News, published by the Heartland Institute. That's heartland.org, HEARTLAND.org. They're up in Chicago, Illinois. Well, I'm about out of time. I got to leave it right there. So we'll take this up again tomorrow night, same time, same station. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour brings you timely reports on science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. All right. My producer says time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.